And she looks younger every day,
Paula, Blaine's ex-girlfriend, said.
Marcia, are you going to bottle your secret?
A woman whom Ifemelu did not know asked, her bleached hair bouffant like a platinum helmet.
Her secret is good sex,
Grace said seriously. A Korean-American woman who taught African-American studies, tiny and slender, always in stylishly loose-fitting clothes, so that she seemed to float in a swish of silks.
I'm that rare thing, a Christian left-wing nut, she had told Ifemelu when they first met. Did you hear that, Benny? Marcia asked. Our secret is good sex.
That's right, Benny said, and winked at her.
Hey, anybody see Barack Obama's announcement this morning?
Yes, it's been on the news all day,
Paula said. She was short and blonde, with a clear pinkish complexion, outdoorsy and healthy, that made Ifemelu wonder if she rode horses.
I don't even have a television, Grace said with a self-mocking sigh. I only recently sold out and got a cell phone.
They'll replay it, Benny said.
Let's eat.
It was Sterling, the wealthy one, who Blaine told her came from Boston old money. He and his father had been legacy students at Harvard. He was left-leaning and well-meaning, crippled by his acknowledgement of his own many privileges. He never allowed himself to have an opinion.
Yes, I see what you mean, he said often.
The food was eaten with a lot of praise and wine, the fried chicken, the greens, the pies. Ifemelu took tiny portions, pleased she had snacked on some nuts before they left. She did not like soul food.
I haven't had cornbread this good in years, Nathan said, seated beside her.
He was a literature professor, neurotic and blinky behind his glasses, who Blaine once said was the only person at Yale that he trusted completely. Nathan had told her some months earlier, in a voice filled with hauteur, that he did not read any fiction published after 1930.
It all went downhill after the 30s, he said.
She had told Blaine about it later, and there was an impatience in her tone, almost an accusation, as she added that academics were not intellectuals, they were not curious. They built their stolid tents of specialized knowledge and stayed securely in them. Blaine said,
Oh, Nathan just has his issues. It's not about being an academic.
A new defensiveness had begun to creep into Blaine's tone when they talked about his friends, perhaps because he sensed her discomfort with them. When she attended a talk with him, he would make sure to say it could have been better, or that the first 10 minutes were boring, as though to preempt her own criticisms. The last talk they had attended was his ex-girlfriend Paula's, at a college in Middletown. Paula, standing in front of the classroom, in a dark green wrap dress and boots, sounding fluid and convinced, provoking and charming her audience at the same time. The young, pretty political scientist who would certainly get tenure. She glanced often at Blaine, like a student at a professor, gauging her performance from his expression. As she spoke, Blaine nodded continuously, and once even sighed aloud, as though her words had brought to him a familiar and exquisite epiphany. They had remained good friends, Paula and Blaine, had kept in the same circle after she cheated on him with a woman also named Paula and now called P, to distinguish them from each other.
Our relationship had been in trouble for a while. She said she was just experimenting with P, but I could tell it was much more, and I was right because they are still together,
Blaine told Ifemelu, and it all seemed to her to be too tame, too civil. Even Paula's friendliness towards her seemed too scrubbed clean.
How about we ditch him and go and have one drink?
Paula had said to Ifemelu that evening after her talk, her cheeks flushed from the excitement and relief of having done well.
I'm exhausted, Ifemelu had said.
Blaine said,
And I need to prep for class tomorrow. Let's do something this weekend, okay?
And he hugged her goodbye.
It wasn't too bad, was it?
Blaine asked Ifemelu on their drive back to New Haven.
I was sure you were going to have an orgasm, she said,
and Blaine laughed. She had thought, watching Paula speak, that Paula was comfortable with Blaine's rhythms in a way that she was not, and she thought so now, as she watched Paula eat her third helping of collard greens, sitting next to her girlfriend P, and laughing at something Marcia had said. The woman with the helmet-like hair was eating her collard greens with her fingers.
We humans are not supposed to eat with utensils, she said.
Michael, seated beside Ifemelu, snorted loudly.
"Why don't you just go on and live in a cave?"
he asked, and they all laughed, but Ifemelu was not sure he had been joking. He had no patience for fey talk. She liked him, cornrows running down the length of his scalp, and his expression always wry, scornful of sentimentality.
"Michael's a good cat, but he tries so hard to keep it real that he can seem full of negativity,"
Blaine had said when she first met Michael. Michael had been in prison for a carjacking when he was 19, and he was fond of saying,
"Some black folk don't appreciate education until after they go to prison."
He was a photographer on a fellowship, and the first time Ifemelu saw his photographs, in black and white, in dances of shadow, their delicacy and vulnerability had surprised her. She had expected grittier imagery. Now one of those photographs hung on the wall in Blaine's apartment, opposite her writing desk. From across the table, Paula asked,
"Did I tell you I'm having my students read your blog, Ifemelu? It's interesting how safe their thinking is, and I want to push them out of their comfort zone. I loved the last post, Friendly Tips for the American Non-Black, How to React to an American Black Talking About Blackness."
"That is funny," Marcia said. "I'd love to read that."
Paula brought out her phone and fiddled with it, and then began to read aloud. "Dear American Non-Black, if an American black person is telling you about an experience about being black, please do not eagerly bring up examples from your own life. Don't say, 'It's just like when I—' You have suffered. Everyone in the world has suffered, but you have not suffered precisely because you are an American black. Don't be quick to find alternative explanations for what happened. Don't say, 'Oh, it's not really race, it's class. Oh, it's not race, it's gender. Oh, it's not race, it's the Cookie Monster.' You see, American blacks actually don't want it to be race. They would rather not have racist shit happen. So maybe when they say something is about race, it's maybe because it actually is. Don't say, 'I'm colorblind,' because if you are colorblind, then you need to see a doctor. And it means that when a black man is shown on TV as a crime suspect in your neighborhood, all you see is a blurry, purplish-grayish, creamish figure. Don't say, 'We're tired of talking about race,' or 'The only race is the human race.' American blacks, too, are tired of talking about race. They wish they didn't have to. But shit keeps happening. So don't preface your response with, 'One of my best friends is black,' because it makes no difference and nobody cares, and you can have a black best friend and still do racist shit, and it's probably not true anyway. The best part, not the friend part. Don't say your grandfather was Mexican so you can't be racist. Please click here for more on 'There is no United League of the Oppressed.' Don't bring up your Irish great-grandparents' suffering. Of course they got a lot of shit from established America. So did the Italians, so did the Eastern Europeans. But there is a hierarchy. 100 years ago, the white ethnics hated being hated. But it was sort of tolerable, because at least black people were below them on the ladder. So don't say your grandfather was a serf in Russia when slavery happened, because what matters is you are American now. And being American means you take the whole shebang, America's assets and America's debts, and Jim Crow is a big-ass debt. Don't say it's just like anti-Semitism. It's not. In the hatred of Jews, there is also the possibility of envy. They are so clever, these Jews. They control everything, these Jews. And one must concede that a certain respect, however grudging, accompanies envy. In the hatred of American blacks, there is no possibility of envy. They're so lazy, these blacks. They're so unintelligent, these blacks. Don't say, 'Oh, racism is over. Slavery was so long ago.' We are talking about problems from the 1960s, not the 1860s. If you meet an elderly American black man from Alabama, he probably remembers when he had to step off the curb because a white person was walking past. I bought a dress from a vintage shop on eBay the other day, made in 1960, in perfect shape. And I wear it a lot. When the original owner wore it, black Americans could not vote because they were black. And maybe the original owner was one of those women in the famous sepia photographs, standing by in hordes outside school shouting, 'Ape!' at young black children, because they did not want them to go to school with their young white children. Where are those women now? Do they sleep well? Do they think about shouting, 'Ape?' Finally, don't put on a 'let's be fair' tone. And say,
But black people are racist, too, because of course we're all prejudiced. I can't even stand some of my blood relatives grasping, selfish folks. But racism is about the power of a group, and in America, it's white folks who have that power. How? Well, white folks don't get treated like shit in upper-class African-American communities, and white folks don't get denied bank loans or mortgages precisely because they are white. And black juries don't give white criminals worse sentences than black criminals for the same crime. And black police officers don't stop white folk for driving while white. And black companies don't choose not to hire somebody because their name sounds white. And black teachers don't tell white kids that they're not smart enough to be doctors. And black politicians don't try some tricks to reduce the voting power of white folks through gerrymandering. And advertising agencies don't say they can't use white models to advertise glamorous products because they are not considered aspirational by the mainstream. So after this listing of don'ts, what's the do? I'm not sure. Try listening, maybe? Hear what is being said? And remember that it's not about you. American blacks are not telling you that you are to blame. They are just telling you what is. If you don't understand, ask questions. If you're uncomfortable about asking questions, say you are uncomfortable about asking questions, and then ask anyway. It's easy to tell when a question is coming from a good place. Then listen some more. Sometimes people just want to feel heard. Here's the possibilities of friendship and connection and understanding.
Marcia said, "I love the part about the dress."
"It's cringe funny," Nathan said.
"So you must be raking in the speaking fees from that blog,"
Michael said.
"Only most of it goes to my hungry relatives back in Nigeria," Ifemelu said. "It must be good to have that."
He said,
"To have what?" "To know where you're from, ancestors going way back, that kind of thing."
"Well," she said, "yes." He looked at her with an expression that made her uncomfortable, because she was not sure what his eyes held, and then he looked away. Blaine was telling Marcia's friend with the helmet-like hair,
"We need to get over that myth. There was nothing Judeo-Christian about American history. Nobody liked Catholics and Jews. It's Anglo-Protestant values, not Judeo-Christian values. Even Maryland very quickly stopped being so Catholic-friendly."
He stopped abruptly and brought his phone out of his pocket and got up.
"Excuse me, folks,"
he said, and then in a lower voice to Ifemelu,
"It's Shan. I'll be right back,"
and walked into the kitchen to take the call. Benny turned on the TV, and they watched Barack Obama, a thin man in a black coat that looked a size too big, his demeanor slightly uncertain. As he spoke, puffs of cloudy steam left his mouth, like smoke in the cold air.
"And that is why, in the shadow of the old state capitol, where Lincoln once called on a divided house to stand together, where common hopes and common dreams still live, I stand before you today to announce my candidacy for the President of the United States of America." "I can't believe they've talked him into this. The guy has potential, but he needs to grow first. He needs some heft. He'll ruin it for black people because he won't come close, and a black person won't be able to run for the next 50 years in this country,"
Gray said.
"He just makes me feel good," Marcia said, laughing. "I love that, the idea of building a more hopeful America." "Well, I think he stands a chance,"
Benny said.
"Oh, he can't win. They'd shoot his ass first,"
Michael said. "It's so refreshing to see a politician who gets nuance," Paula said. "Yes," P said. She had overly toned arms, thin and bulging with muscle, a pixie haircut, and an air of intense anxiety. She was the sort of person whose love would suffocate. "He sounds so smart, so articulate."
"You sound like my mother," Paula said, in the barbed tone of a private fight being continued, words meaning other things.
"Why is it so remarkable that he's articulate?"
"Are we hormonal, Polly?" Marcia asked.
"She is," P said. "Did you see she's eaten all the fried chicken?"
Paula ignored P, and as though in defiance, reached out to have another slice of pumpkin pie.
What do you think of Obama, Ifemelu? Marcia asked, and Ifemelu guessed that Benny or Grace had whispered her name into Marcia's ear, and now Marcia was eager to unleash her new knowledge.
I like Hillary Clinton, Ifemelu said. I don't really know anything about this Obama guy.
Blaine came back into the room.
What did I miss?
Shanoki, Ifemelu asked. Blaine nodded.
It doesn't matter what anybody thinks of Obama. The real question is whether white people are ready for a black president, Nathan said.
I'm ready for a black president, but I don't think the nation is,
P said. Seriously, have you been talking to my mom? Paula asked her. She said the exact same thing. If you're ready for a black president, then who exactly is this vague country that isn't ready? People say that when they can't say that they are not ready. And even the idea of being ready is ridiculous.
Ifemelu borrowed those words months later, in a blog post written during the final, frenzied lap of the presidential campaign. Even the idea of being ready is ridiculous. Does nobody see how absurd it is to ask people if they are ready for a black president? Are you ready for Mickey Mouse to be president? How about Kermit the Frog and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer?
My family has impeccable liberal credentials. We've ticked all the right boxes, Paula said, lips turned down in irony, twirling the stem of her empty wine glass. But my parents were always quick to tell their friends that Blaine was at Yale, as if they were saying, he's one of the few good ones.
You're being too hard on them, Polly,
Blaine said.
No, really. Didn't you think so? She asked. Remember that awful Thanksgiving at my parents' house?
You mean how I wanted mac and cheese?
Paula laughed.
No, that's not what I mean.
But she did not say what she meant, and so the memory was left unaired, wrapped in their shared privacy. Back in Blaine's apartment, Ifemelu told him, I was jealous. It was jealousy, the twinge of unease, the unsettledness in her stomach. Paula had the air of a real ideologue. She could, Ifemelu imagined, slip easily into anarchy, stand at the forefront of protests, defying the clubs of policemen and the taunts of unbelievers. To sense this about Paula was to feel wanting compared to her.
There's nothing to be jealous about, Ifem,
Blaine said.
The fried chicken you eat is not the fried chicken I eat, but it's the fried chicken that Paula eats.
What?
For you and Paula, fried chicken is battered. For me, fried chicken has no batter. I just thought about how you both have a lot in common.
We have fried chicken in common. Do you realize how loaded fried chicken is as a metaphor here?
Blaine was laughing, a gentle, affectionate laugh.
Your jealousy is kind of sweet, but there is no chance at all of anything going on.
She knew there was nothing going on. Blaine would not cheat on her. He was too sinewy with goodness. Fidelity came easily to him. He did not turn to glance at pretty women on the street, because it did not occur to him. But she was jealous of the emotional remnants that existed between him and Paula, and by the thought that Paula was like him, good like him. Traveling while black. A friend of a friend, a cool A.B. with tons of money, is writing a book called Traveling While Black. Not just black, he says, but recognizably black, because there's all kinds of black, and no offense, but he doesn't mean those black folk who look Puerto Rican or Brazilian or whatever. He means recognizably black. Because the world treats you differently. So here's what he says. I got the idea for the book in Egypt. So I get to Cairo and this Egyptian Arab guy calls me a black barbarian. I'm like, hey, this is supposed to be Africa. So I started thinking about other parts of the world and what it would be like to travel there if you're black. I'm as black as they get. White folk in the South today would look at me and think, there goes a big black buck. They tell you in the guidebooks what to expect if you're gay or if you're a woman. Hell, they need to do it for if you're recognizably black. Let traveling black folk know what the deal is. It's not like anybody's going to shoot you, but it's great to know where to expect that people will stare at you. In the German Black Forest, it's pretty hostile staring. In Tokyo and Istanbul, everyone was cool and indifferent. In Shanghai, the staring was intense.
In Delhi, it was nasty. I thought, hey, aren't we kind of in this together? You know, people of color and all. I'd been reading that Brazil is the race mecca. And I go to Rio, and nobody looks like me in the nice restaurants and the nice hotels. People act funny when I'm walking to the first-class line at the airport. Kind of nice funny, like, you're making a mistake. You can't look like that and fly first class. I go to Mexico, and they're staring at me. It's not hostile at all, but it just makes you know you stick out. Kind of like, they like you, but you're still King Kong. And at this point, my Professor Hunk says, Latin America as a whole has a really complicated relationship with blackness, which is overshadowed by that whole we are all mestizo story that they tell themselves. Mexico isn't as bad as places like Guatemala and Peru, where the white privilege is so much more overt, but then those countries have a much more sizable black population. And then another friend says, native blacks are always treated worse than non-native blacks everywhere in the world. My friend who was born and raised in France, of Togolese parents, pretends to be Anglophone when she goes shopping in Paris, because the shop attendants are nicer to black people who don't speak French. Just like American blacks get a lot of respect in African countries. Thoughts? Please post your own travelling tales. Chapter 37. It seemed to Ifemelu as though she had glanced away for a moment and looked back to find DK transformed. Her little cousin was gone, and in his place a boy who did not look like a boy, 6 feet tall with lean muscles, playing basketball for Willow High School, and dating the nimble blonde girl, Paige, who wore tiny skirts and Converse sneakers. Once when Ifemelu asked, "So, how are things going with Paige?" DK replied, "We're not yet having sex, if that's what you want to know." In the evenings, 6 or 7 friends converged in his room, all of them white except for Min, the tall Chinese boy whose parents taught at the university. They played computer games and watched videos on YouTube, needling and jousting, all of them enclosed in a sparkling arc of careless youth, and at their center was DK. They all laughed at DK's jokes and looked to him for agreement, and in a delicate, unspoken way, they let him make their collective decisions, ordering pizza, going down to the community center to play ping-pong. With them, DK changed. He took on a swagger in his voice and in his gait, his shoulders squared, as though in a high-gear performance, and sprinkled his speech with ain't and y'all. "Why do you talk like that when you're with your friends, DK?" Ifemelu asked. "Yo, cuz, how you gonna treat me like that?" he said, with an exaggerated funny face that made her laugh. Ifemelu imagined him at college. He would be a perfect student guide, leading a pack of would-be students and their parents, showing them the wonderful things about the campus, and making sure to add one thing he personally disliked, all the time being relentlessly funny and bright and bouncy, and the girls would have instant crushes on him, the boys would be envious of his panache, and the parents would wish their kids were like him. Shan wore a sparkly gold top, her breasts unbound, swinging as she moved. She flirted with everyone, touching an arm, hugging too closely, lingering over a cheek kiss. Her compliments were clotted with an extravagance that made them seem insincere, yet her friends smiled and bloomed under them. It did not matter what was said. It mattered that it was Shan who said it. Her first time at Shan's salon, and Ifemelu was nervous. There was no need to be. It was a mere gathering of friends, but still, she was nervous. She had agonized about what to wear, tried on and discarded 9 outfits before she decided on a teal dress that made her waist look small. "Hey," Shan said when Blaine and Ifemelu arrived, exchanging hugs. "Is Grace coming?" she asked Blaine.
"Yes, she's taking the later train."
"Great, I haven't seen her in ages."
Shan lowered her voice and said to Ifemelu,
"I heard Grace steals her students' research."
"What?"
"Grace. I heard she steals her students' research. Did you know that?"
"No," Ifemelu said. She found it strange, Shan telling her this about Blaine's friend, and yet it made her feel special, admitted into Shan's intimate cave of gossip. Then, suddenly ashamed that she had not been strong enough in her defense of Grace, whom she liked, she said, "I don't think that's true at all.
But Chan's attention was already elsewhere. I want you to meet the sexiest man in New York, Omar. Chan said, introducing Ifemelu to a man as tall as a basketball player, whose hairline was too perfectly shaped, a sharp curve sweeping his forehead, sharp angles dipping near his ears. When Ifemelu reached out to shake his hand, he bowed slightly, hand on his chest, and smiled. Omar doesn't touch women to whom he is not related, Chan said, which is very sexy, no? And she tilted her head to look up suggestively at Omar. This is beautiful and utterly original Mary Bell and her girlfriend Joan, who is just as beautiful. They make me feel bad, Chan said, while Mary Bell and Joan giggled, smallish white women in dark-framed oversized glasses. They both wore short dresses, one in red polka dot, the other lace-fringed, with the slightly faded, slightly ill-fitting look of vintage shop finds. It was, in some ways, costume. They ticked the boxes of a certain kind of enlightened, educated middle-classness, the love of dresses that were more interesting than pretty, the love of the eclectic, the love of what they were supposed to love. If Emelu imagined them when they travelled, they would collect unusual things and fill their homes with them, unpolished evidence of their polish. "Here's Bill," Chan said, hugging the muscular dark man in a fedora. "Bill is a writer, but unlike the rest of us, he has oodles of money." Chan was almost cooing. "Bill has this great idea for a travel book called Traveling While Black."
"I'd love to hear about it," Ashanti said.
"By the way, Ashanti, girl, I adore your hair," Chan said.
"Thank you," Ashanti said. She was a vision in cowries. They rattled from her wrists, were strung through her curled dreadlocks, and looped around her neck. She said, "Motherland" and "Yoruba religion" often, glancing at Ifemelu as though for confirmation, and it was a parody of Africa that Ifemelu felt uncomfortable about, and then felt bad for feeling so uncomfortable.
"You finally have a book cover you like?" Ashanti asked Chan.
"Like is a strong word," Chan said. "So, everyone, this book is a memoir, right? It's about tons of stuff growing up in this all-white town, being the only black kid in my prep school, my mom's passing, all that stuff. My editor reads the manuscript and says, 'I understand that race is important here, but we have to make sure the book transcends race, so that it's not just about race.' And I'm thinking, but why do I have to transcend race? You know, like race is a brew best served mild, tempered with other liquids, otherwise white folk can't swallow it."
"That's funny," Blaine said.
He kept flagging the dialogue in the manuscript and writing on the margins, "Do people actually say this?" And I'm thinking, hey, how many black people do you know? I mean, know as equals, as friends. I don't mean the receptionist in the office, and maybe the one black couple whose kid goes to your kid's school and you say hi to. I mean, really, no? None. So how are you telling me how black people talk?
Not his fault. There aren't enough middle-class black folks to go around, Bill said. Lots of liberal white folks are looking for black friends. It's almost as hard as finding an egg donor who is a tall, blonde, 18-year-old at Harvard.
They all laughed.
I wrote this scene about something that happened in grad school, about a Gambian woman I knew. She loved to eat baking chocolate. She always had a pack of baking chocolate in her bag anyway. She lived in London, and she was in love with this white English guy, and he was leaving his wife for her. So we were in a bar, and she was telling a few of us about it, me and this other girl and this guy, Peter, short guy from Wisconsin. And you know what Peter said to her? He said, 'His wife must feel worse knowing you're black.' He said it like it was pretty obvious. Not that the wife would feel bad about another woman, period, but that she would feel bad because a woman was black. So I put it in the book. And my editor wants to change it because he says it's not subtle, like life is always fucking subtle. And then I write about my mom being bitter at work because she felt like she hit a ceiling and they wouldn't let her get further because she was black. And my editor says, 'Can we have more nuance? Did your mom have a bad rapport with someone at work, maybe? Or had she already been diagnosed with cancer?' He thinks we should complicate it, so it's not race alone. And I say, but it was race. She was bitter because she thought if everything was the same except for her race, she would have been made vice president. And she talked about it a lot until she died. But somehow my mom's experience is suddenly unnuanced. Nuance means
keep people comfortable so everyone is free to think of themselves as individuals, and everyone got where they are because of their achievement.
Maybe you should turn it into a novel, Maribel said.
Are you kidding me?
Shan asked, slightly drunk, slightly dramatic, and now sitting yoga style on the floor.
You can't write an honest novel about race in this country. If you write about how people are really affected by race, it'll be too obvious.
Black writers who do literary fiction in this country, all three of them, not the 10,000 who write those bullshit ghetto books with the bright covers, have two choices. They can do precious, or they can do pretentious. When you do neither, nobody knows what to do with you. So if you're going to write about race, you have to make sure it's so lyrical and subtle that the reader who doesn't read between the lines won't even know it's about race. You know, a Proustian meditation, all watery and fuzzy, that at the end just leaves you feeling watery and fuzzy.
Or just find a white writer. White writers can be blunt about race and get all activist because their anger isn't threatening.
Gray said,
What about this recent book, Monk Memoirs?
Mirabel said.
It's a cowardly, dishonest book. Have you read it?
Shan asked.
I read a review,
Mirabel said.
That's the problem. You read more about books than you read actual books.
Maribel blushed. She would, if Emelu sensed, take this quietly, only from Shan.
We are very ideological about fiction in this country. If a character is not familiar, then that character becomes unbelievable,
Shan said.
You can't even read American fiction to get a sense of how actual life is lived these days. You read American fiction to learn about dysfunctional white folk doing things that are weird to normal white folks.
Everyone laughed. Shan looked delighted, like a little girl showing off her singing to her parents' eminent friends.
The world just doesn't look like this room,
Gray said.
But it can,
Blaine said.
We prove that the world can be like this room. It can be a safe and equal space for everyone. We just need to dismantle the walls of privilege and oppression.
There goes my flower child brother,
Shan said. There was more laughter.
You should blog about this, Ifemelu,
Gray said.
You know why Ifemelu can write that blog, by the way?
Shan said.
Because she's African. She's writing from the outside. She doesn't really feel all the stuff she's writing about. It's all quaint and curious to her. So she can write it and get all these accolades and get invited to give talks. If she were African-American, she'd just be labeled angry and shunned.
The room was, for a moment, swollen in silence.
I think that's fair enough,
Ifemelu said, disliking Shan, and herself too for bending to Shan's spell. It was true that race was not embroidered in the fabric of her history. It had not been etched on her soul. Still, she wished Shan had said this to her when they were alone, instead of saying it now so jubilantly in front of friends, and leaving Ifemelu with an embittered knot, like bereavement in her chest.
A lot of this is relatively recent. Black and Pan-African identities were actually strong in the early 19th century. The Cold War forced people to choose, and it was either you become an internationalist, which of course meant communist to Americans, or you became a part of American capitalism, which was the choice the African-American elite made.
Blaine said, as though in Ifemelu's defense, but she thought it too abstract, too limp, too late. Shan glanced at Ifemelu and smiled, and in that smile was the possibility of great cruelty. When months later Ifemelu had the fight with Blaine, she wondered if Shan had fueled his anger, an anger she never fully understood. Is Obama anything but black? So lots of folk, mostly non-black, say Obama's not black. He's biracial, multiracial, black and white. Anything but just black, because his mother was white. But race is not biology. Race is sociology. Race is not genotype. Race is phenotype. Race matters because of racism, and racism is absurd because it's about how you look, not about the blood you have. It's about the shade of your skin and the shape of your nose and the kink of your hair. Booker T. Washington and Frederick Douglass had white fathers. Imagine them saying they were not black. Imagine Obama, skin the color of a toasted almond, hair kinky, saying to a census worker, I'm kind of white.
Sure you are, she'll say.
Many American blacks have a white person in their ancestry, because white slave owners like to go a-raping in the slave quarters at night. But if you come out looking dark, that's it. So if you are that blonde, blue-eyed woman who says, "My grandfather was Native American, and I get discrimination too," when black folk are talking about shit, please stop it already. In America, you don't get to decide what race you are. It is decided for you. Barack Obama, looking as he does, would have had to sit in the back of the bus 50 years ago. If a random black guy commits a crime today, Barack Obama could be stopped and questioned for fitting the profile. And what would that profile be? Black man. Chapter 38. Blaine did not like Boubacar, and perhaps this mattered, or perhaps it did not matter in the story of their fight, but Blaine did not like Boubacar. And her day began with visiting Boubacar's class. She and Blaine had met Boubacar at a university-hosted dinner party in his honor. A sable-skinned Senegalese professor who had just moved to the U.S. to teach at Yale. He was blistering in his intelligence and blistering in his self-regard. He sat at the head of the table, drinking red wine and talking dryly of French presidents whom he had met, of the French universities that had offered him jobs.
"I came to America because I want to choose my own master," he said. "If I must have a master, then better America than France. But I will never eat a cookie or go to McDonald's. How barbaric."
Ifemelu was charmed and amused by him. She liked his accent, his English drenched in Wolof and French.
"I thought he was great," she told Blaine later.
"It's interesting how he says ordinary things and thinks that they're pretty deep," Blaine said. "He has a bit of an ego, but so did everyone at that table,"
Ifemelu said.
"Aren't you Yale people supposed to, before you get hired?"
Blaine did not laugh as he ordinarily would have. She sensed in his reaction a territorial dislike that was foreign to his nature. It surprised her. He would put on a bad French accent and mimic Boubacar.
"Francophone Africans, break for coffee. Anglophone Africans, break for tea. It is impossible to get real café au lait in this country."
Perhaps he resented how easily she had drifted to Boubacar that day, after desserts were served, as though to a person who spoke the same silent language as she did. She had teased Boubacar about Francophone Africans, how battered their minds were by the French, and how thin-skinned they had become, too aware of European slights, and yet too enamoured of European-ness. Boubacar laughed, a familial laugh. He would not laugh like that with an American. He would be cutting if an American dared say the same thing. Perhaps Blaine resented this mutuality, something primarily African from which he felt excluded. But her feelings for Boubacar were fraternal, free of desire. They met often for tea in Atticus' bookstore, and talked, or she listened, he did most of the talking, about West African politics and family and home. And she left always with the feeling of having been fortified. By the time Boubacar told her about the new Humanities Fellowship at Princeton, she had begun to gaze at her past. A restlessness had taken hold of her. Her doubts about her blog had grown.
"You must apply. It would be perfect for you," he said.
"I'm not an academic. I don't even have a graduate degree."
"The current fellow is a jazz musician, very brilliant, but he has only a high school diploma. They want people who are doing new things, pushing boundaries. You must apply, and please, use me as a reference. We need to get into these places, you know. It is the only way to change the conversation."
She was touched, sitting across from him in a cafe and feeling between them the warm affinities of something shared. Boubacar had often invited her to visit his class, a seminar on contemporary African issues.
"You might find something to blog about," he said.
And so, on the day that began the story of her fight with Blaine, she visited Boubacar's class. She sat at the back by the window. Outside, the leaves were falling from grand old trees. People with scarf-bundled necks hurried along the sidewalk holding paper cups. The women, particularly the Asian women, pretty in slender skirts and high-heeled boots. Boubacar's students all had laptops open in front of them, the screens bright with email pages Google searches, celebrity photos. From time to time they would open a word file and type a few words from Boubacar. Their jackets were hung behind their chairs, and their body language, slouching, slightly impatient, said this: "We already know the answers." After class they would go to the cafe in the library and buy a sandwich with Joe from North Africa or a curry from India, and on their way to another class a student group would give them condoms and lollipops, and in the evening they would attend tea in a master's house where a Latin American president or a Nobel laureate would answer their questions as though they mattered. "Your students were all browsing the Internet," she told Boubacar as they walked back to his office.
"They do not doubt their presence here, these students. They believe they should be here. They have earned it, and they are paying for it. Au fond, they have bought us all. It is the key to America's greatness, this hubris,"
Boubacar said, a black felt beret on his head, his hands sunk in his jacket pockets.
"That is why they do not understand that they should be grateful to have me stand before them."
They had just arrived at his office when there was a knock on the half-open door.
"Come in,"
Boubacar said. Kavanagh came in. Ifemelu had met him a few times, an assistant professor of history who had lived in Congo as a child. He was curly-haired and foul-humoured, and seemed better suited for covering dangerous wars in far-flung countries than for teaching history to undergraduates. He stood at the door and told Boubacar that he was leaving on a sabbatical, and the department was ordering sandwiches the next day as a going-away lunch for him, and he had been told they were fancy sandwiches, with such things as alfalfa sprouts.
"If I am bald enough, I will stop by," Boubacar said.
"You should come,"
Kavanagh said to Ifemelu.
"Really?"
"I'll come," she said. "Free lunch is always a good idea." As she left Boubacar's office, Blaine sent her a text.
"Did you hear about Mr. White at the library?"
Her first thought was that Mr. White had died. She did not feel any great sadness, and for this she felt guilty. Mr. White was a security guard at the library who sat at the exit and checked the back flap of each book, a roomy-eyed man with skin so dark it had an undertone of blueberries. She was so used to seeing him seated, a face and a torso, that the first time she saw him walking, his gait saddened her. His shoulders stooped, as though burdened by lingering losses. Blaine had befriended him years ago, and sometimes during his break, Blaine would stand outside talking to him.
"He's a history book,"
Blaine told her. She had met Mr. White a few times.
"Does she have a sister?"
Mr. White would ask Blaine, gesturing to her. Or he would say,
"You look tired, my man. Somebody keep you up late?"
In a way Ifemelu thought inappropriate. Whenever they shook hands, Mr. White squeezed her fingers, a gesture thick with suggestion, and she would pull her hand free and avoid his eyes until they left. There was in that handshake a claiming, a leering, and for this she had always harbored a small dislike. But she had never told Blaine, because she was also sorry about her dislike. Mr. White was, after all, an old black man beaten down by life, and she wished she could overlook the liberties he took.
"Funny how I've never heard you speak Ebonics before," she told Blaine, the first time she had heard him talking to Mr. White.
His syntax was different, his cadences more rhythmic.
"I guess I've become too used to my 'white people are watching us' voice," he said. "And you know, younger black folk don't really do code-switching anymore. The middle-class kids can't speak Ebonics, and the inner-city kids speak only Ebonics, and they don't have the fluidity that my generation has."
"I'm going to blog about that."
"I knew you would say that."
She sent Blaine a text back. "No, what happened? Is Mr. White okay? Are you done? Want to get a sandwich?" Blaine called her and asked her to wait for him on the corner of Whitney, and soon she saw him walking towards her, a quick-moving trim figure in a grey sweater.
"Hey,"
he said, and kissed her.
"You smell nice," she said, and he kissed her again.
"You survived Boubacar's class, even though there were no proper croissant or pain au chocolat."
"Stop it. What happened to Mr. White?" As they walked hand in hand to the bagel sandwich store, he told her how Mr. White's friend, a black man, came by yesterday evening, and the two stood outside the library. Mr. White gave his friend his car keys, because the friend wanted to borrow his car, and the friend gave Mr. White some money, which Mr. White had lent him earlier. A white library employee, watching them, assumed that the two black men were dealing drugs and called a supervisor. The supervisor called the police. The police came and led Mr. White away to be questioned.
"Oh, my God," Ifemelu said. "Is he okay?"
"Yes, he's back at his desk."
Blaine paused.
"I think he expects this sort of thing to happen."
"That's the actual tragedy," Ifemelu said, and realized she was using Blaine's own words. Sometimes she heard in her voice the echo of his. The actual tragedy of Emmett Till, he had told her once, was not the murder of a black child for whistling at a white woman, but that some black people thought, "But why did you whistle?"
"I talked to him for a bit. He just shrugged the whole thing off and said it wasn't a big deal, and instead he wanted to talk about his daughter, who he's really worried about. She's talking about dropping out of high school, so I'm going to step in and tutor her. I'm going to meet her Monday."
"Blaine, that's the seventh kid you'll be tutoring," she said. "Are you going to tutor the whole of inner city New Haven?" It was windy, and he was squinting, cars driving past them on Whitney Avenue, and he turned to glance at her with narrowed eyes.
"I wish I could,"
he said quietly.
"I just want to see more of you," she said, and slipped an arm around his waist. "The university's response is total bullshit. A simple mistake that wasn't racial at all? Really? I'm thinking of organizing a protest tomorrow. Get people to come out and say this is not okay, not in our backyard."
He had already decided, she could tell. He was not merely thinking about it. He sat down at a table by the door while she went up to the counter to order, seamlessly ordering for him because she was so used to him, to what he liked. When she came back with a plastic tray, her turkey sandwich and his veggie wrap lying beside two bags of baked unsalted chips, his head was bent to his phone. By evening, he had made calls and sent emails and texts, and the news had been passed on, and his phone jingled and rang and beeped with responses from people saying they were on board. A student called to ask him for suggestions about what to write on placards. Another student was contacting the local TV stations. The next morning, before he left for class, Blaine said,
"I'm teaching back-to-back, so I'll see you at the library. Text me when you're on your way."
They had not discussed it. He had simply assumed that she would be there, and so she said, "Okay." But she did not go. And she did not forget. Blaine might have been more forgiving if she had simply forgotten, if she had been so submerged in reading or blogging that the protest had slipped from her mind. But she did not forget. She merely preferred to go to Kavanagh's going-away lunch instead of standing in front of the university library holding a placard. Blaine would not mind too much, she told herself. If she felt any discomfort, she was not conscious of it until she was seated in a classroom with Kavanagh and Boubacar and other professors, sipping a bottle of cranberry juice, listening to a young woman talk about her upcoming tenure review, when Blaine's texts flooded her phone.
"Where are you? You okay? Great turnout. Looking for you. Chan just surprised me and turned up. You okay?"
She left early and went back to the apartment, and lying in bed, sent Blaine a text to say she was so sorry. She was just up from a nap that had gone on too long.
"Okay. On my way home."
He walked in and wrapped her in his arms with a force and an excitement that had come through the door with him.
"I missed you. I really wanted you to be there. I was so happy Shan came," he said,
a little emotional, as though it had been a personal triumph of his.
"It was like a mini-America. Black kids and white kids and Asian kids and Hispanic kids. Mr. White's daughter was there, taking pictures of his photos on the placard, and I felt as if that finally gave him some real dignity back."
"That's lovely," she said.
"Shan says hello. She's getting on the train back now."
It would have been easy for Blaine to find out, perhaps a casual mention from someone who had been at the lunch, but she never knew exactly how he did. He came back the next day and looked at her, a glare like silver in his eyes, and said,
"You lied."
It was said with a kind of horror that baffled her, as though he had never considered it possible that she could lie. She wanted to say, "Blaine, people lie." But she said,
"I'm sorry." "Why?"
He was looking at her as though she had reached in and torn away his innocence, and for a moment she hated him, this man who ate her apple cores and turned even that into something of a moral act.
I don't know why, Blaine. I just didn't feel up to it. I didn't think you would mind too much.
You just didn't feel up to it?
I'm sorry. I should have told you about the lunch.
How is this lunch suddenly so important? You hardly even know this Bubaka's colleague,
he said, incredulous.
You know, it's not just about writing a blog. You have to live like you believe it. That blog is a game that you don't really take seriously. It's like choosing an interesting elective evening class to complete your credits, he said.
She recognized in his tone a subtle accusation, not merely about her laziness, her lack of zeal and conviction, but also about her Africanness. She was not sufficiently furious because she was African, not African-American.
It's unfair of you to say that, she said,
but he had turned away from her, icy, silent.
Why won't you talk to me? She asked.
I don't understand why this matters so much. How can you not understand? It's the principle of it, he said,
and at that moment he became a stranger to her.
I'm really sorry, she said.
He had walked into the bathroom and shut the door. She felt withered in his wordless rage. How could principle, an abstract thing floating in the air, wedge itself so solidly between them and turn Blaine into somebody else? She wished it were an uncivil emotion, a passion like jealousy or betrayal. She called Araminta.
I feel like the confused wife calling her sister-in-law to explain her husband to her, she said.
In high school, I remember there was some fundraiser, and they put out a table with cookies and whatever, and you were supposed to put some money in the jar and take a cookie. And, you know, I'm feeling rebellious, so I just take a cookie and don't put any money in. And Blaine was furious with me. I remember thinking, hey, it's just a cookie. But I think for him it was the principle of it. He can be ridiculously high-minded sometimes. Give him a day or two, he'll get over this.
But a day passed, then two, and Blaine remained caged in his frozen silence. On the third day of his not saying a single word to her, she packed a small bag and left. She could not go back to Baltimore. Her condo was rented out and her furniture in storage, and so she went to Willow.
What academics mean by white privilege? Or, yes, it sucks to be poor and white, but try being poor and non-white.
So this guy said to Professor Hunk, white privilege is nonsense. How can I be privileged? I grew up fucking poor in West Virginia. I'm an Appalachian hick. My family is on welfare.
Right. But privilege is always relative to something else. Now imagine someone like him, as poor and as fucked up, and then make that person black. If both are caught for drug possession, say, the white guy is more likely to be sent to treatment, and the black guy is more likely to be sent to jail. Everything else, the same, except for race. Check the stats. The Appalachian hick guy is fucked up, which is not cool, but if he were black, he'd be fucked up plus. He also said to Professor Hunk, why must we always talk about race anyway? Can't we just be human beings? And Professor Hunk replied, that is exactly what white privilege is. That you can say that. Race doesn't really exist for you because it has never been a barrier. Black folks don't have that choice. The black guy on the street in New York doesn't want to think about race until he tries to hail a cab, and he doesn't want to think about race when he's driving his Mercedes under the speed limit until a cop pulls him over. So Appalachian hick guy doesn't have class privilege, but he sure as hell has race privilege. What do you think? Weigh in, readers, and share your experiences. Especially if you're non-black. P.S. Professor Hunk just suggested I post this. A test for white privilege. Copyright a pretty cool woman called Peggy McIntosh. If you answer mostly no, then congratulations, you have white privilege. What's the point of this, you ask? Seriously? I have no idea. I guess it's just good to know, so you can gloat from time to time, lift you up when you're depressed, that sort of thing. So, here goes. When you want to join a prestigious social club, do you wonder if your race will make it difficult for you to join? When you go shopping alone at a nice store, do you worry that you will be followed or harassed? When you turn on mainstream TV or open a mainstream newspaper, do you expect to find mostly people of another race? Do you worry that your children will not have books and school materials that are about people of their own race? When you apply for a bank loan, do you worry that because of your race, you might be seen as financially unreliable? If you swear or dress shabbily, do you think that people might say this is because of the bad morals or the poverty or the illiteracy of your race?
If you do well in a situation, do you expect to be called a credit to your race, or to be described as different from the majority of your race? If you criticize the government, do you worry that you might be seen as a cultural outsider, or that you might be asked to go back to X, X being somewhere not in America? If you receive poor service in a nice store and ask to see the person in charge, do you expect that this person will be a person of another race? If a traffic cop pulls you over, do you wonder if it is because of your race? If you take a job with an affirmative action employer, do you worry that your co-workers will think you are unqualified and were hired only because of your race? If you want to move to a nice neighborhood, do you worry that you might not be welcome because of your race? If you need legal or medical help, do you worry that your race might work against you? When you use a nude color of underwear and band-aids, do you already know that it will not match your skin? Chapter 39. Auntie Uju had taken up yoga. She was on her hands and knees, back arched high, on a bright blue mat on the basement floor, while Ifemelu lay on the couch, eating a chocolate bar and watching her.
How many of those things have you eaten? And since when do you eat regular chocolate? I thought you and Blaine eat only organic fair trade.
I bought them at the train station.
Them? How many?
10.
Ah, 10.
Ifemelu shrugged. She had already eaten them all, but she would not tell Auntie Uju that. It had given her pleasure, buying chocolate bars from the newsstand, cheap bars filled with sugar and chemicals and other genetically modified ghastly things.
Oh, so because you are quarreling with Blaine, you are now eating the chocolate he doesn't like.
Auntie Uju laughed. DK came downstairs and looked at his mother, her arms now up in the air. Warrior position.
Mom, you look ridiculous.
Didn't your friend say that your mother was hot the other day? This is why.
DK shook his head.
Cuz, I need to show you something on YouTube, this hilarious video.
Ifemelu got up.
Has DK told you about the computer incident at school?
Auntie Uju asked.
No, what?
Ifemelu asked.
The principal called me on Monday to say that DK hacked into the school's computer network on Saturday. This is a boy who was with me all day on Saturday. We went to Hartford to visit Osavisa. We were there the whole day, and the boy did not go near a computer. When I asked why they thought it was him, they said they got information. Imagine, you just wake up and blame my son. The boy is not even good with computers. I thought we had left them behind in that bush town. Kweku wants us to lodge a formal complaint, but I don't think it's worth the time. They have now said they no longer suspect him.
I don't even know how to hack,
DK said dryly.
Why would they do this sort of rubbish?
Ifemelu asked.
You have to blame the black kid first,
he said, and laughed. Later he told her how his friends would say,
Hey, DK, got some weed?
And how funny it was. He told her about the pastor at church, a white woman, who had said hello to all the other kids, but when she came to him, she said, What's up, bro?
I feel like I have vegetables instead of ears, like large broccoli sticking out of my head,
he said, laughing.
So, of course, it had to be me that hacked into the school network.
Those people in your school are fools, Ifemelu said.
So funny how you say that word, cuz. Fools.
He paused and then repeated her words.
Those people in your school are fools.
In a good mimicry of a Nigerian accent. She told him the story of the Nigerian pastor who, while giving a sermon in a church in America, said something about a beach, but because of his accent, his parishioners thought he had said bitch, and they wrote to his bishop to complain. DK laughed and laughed. It became one of their stock jokes.
Hey, cuz, I just want to spend a summer day at the beach,
he would say. For 9 days, Blaine did not take her calls. Finally, he answered the phone, his voice muffled.
Can I come this weekend so we can cook coconut rice? I'll do the cooking, she said.
Before he said,
Okay.
She sensed an intake of breath, and she wondered if he was surprised that she dared to suggest coconut rice. She watched Blaine cutting the onions, watched his long fingers, and recalled them on her body, tracing lines on her collarbone and on the darkened skin below her navel. He looked up and asked if the slices were a good size, and she said, The onion is fine. and thought how he had always known the right size for onions, slicing them so precisely, how he had always steamed the rice, although she was going to do it now. He broke the coconut against the sink and let the